Good morning and welcome back to Midpoint Wednesday. We are your mid-morning, mid-week, mid-Florida source for news and public affairs with a local perspective, and I'm your host, Shelley Reback. This is our first show back since the end of the Florida legislative session, so you know we're going to be talking about that. And we will with my guest today, former Florida Senator Jeff Brandis, a Pinellas County Republican, but a Republican who has pretty consistently challenged Republican orthodoxy in several areas of public policy making. He's now the founder of a think tank called the Florida Policy Project, and he's going to be talking with us about some of the bills that came out of the legislature this year and about the opportunities the legislature missed to make life better for Floridians. But before we get to our primary guest, let's take a look at a few Florida news items of interest this week. On Monday, we learned that notorious Florida man and presidential candidate, I still can't believe I have to say that, Donald J. Trump is now scheduled to be tried in New York in his 2016 hush money case on April 15th, although Trump said he would appeal that start date. Also, a five-judge New York State Appeals Court panel said it would pause the enforcement of the $464 million judgment against Trump, the Trump Organization, and its top executives in his business fraud case if, within 10 days, they post a reduced $175 million bond. And now Donald is selling MAGA Bibles to raise funds. Lordy, it's so embarrassing. Also on Monday, Governor DeSantis signed legislation aimed at kicking minors off of social media. Under the new law, social media platforms are prohibited from allowing children younger than 14 to have an account because state leaders contend that accessing social media is harmful to their development and their mental health. So Florida is ready to protect kids from social media, but apparently not from measles. And in other words, under the new law, even if parents want their tweens to have a social media account, they're out of luck because Florida knows better. This bill was actually a bipartisan effort and was surprisingly supported by some of our local Democratic legislators like Michelle Rayner and Fentress Driscoll. And finally, Florida is about to erase climate change from most of its laws. The state is spending big on adapting to sea level rise, authorizing some $640 million for resilience projects to adapt to rising seas and coastal threats. But Republicans don't want to name the cause of it. A bill awaiting signature from Governor DeSantis would ban all offshore wind energy, relax regulations on natural gas pipelines, and echoing Rick Scott, it would delete the majority of mentions of climate change from all existing state laws. That bill is clearly out of state with what most Floridians want. According to a recent survey from Florida Atlantic University, 90% of the state's residents accept that climate change is happening. But because Republicans associate climate change with Democrats, they see it as a pretext for pushing a progressive agenda, so they try to distance themselves from the issue. In fact, when a reporter asked DeSantis what he was doing to address the climate crisis back in 2021, Governor DeSantis replied, "Well, we're not doing any left-wing stuff," close quote. So is acknowledging climate change smart policy? Does the deletion of it discourage green industries and jobs from coming to Florida? Will clean tech investors maybe see it as a signal that they're not welcome in Florida? That's a few things to think about as we welcome our guest, Jeff Brandis, former Florida State Senator from Pinellas County, District 24, serving from 2016 to 2022. Senator Brandis is a policy wonk who was a rogue Republican, a rare thinking person's Republican who regularly took some positions different from, far from, Republican policy priorities. In the legislature during his time there, he was someone who seemed sincerely interested in governance over politics and in fashioning some policies that would largely improve the lives of Floridians in several important areas. Now that he's out, he's founded his own think tank, the Florida Policy Project, and he's going to tell us about that. So welcome to Midpoint, Jeff Brandis.
Great to be with you.
Let's jump right in. I want to ask you first about the legislature's efforts or lack thereof on the issues that your policy project is particularly focused on. So let's start with property insurance. That's mm-hmm. something you've been focused on as a legislator and now with the policy project. The only thing the legislature did to affect all homeowners' insurance policies this year is that small insurance tax break. So the legislature will now give you around $50. That legislation started out with a plan to cut certain taxes to generate savings that were required to be passed on to the homeowner, but the legislation got much worse by the end of the process. And now the average homeowner savings will be about $55. And they would also allow some unregulated surplus lines insurance companies to take over policies that cover second homes from state-backed citizens property insurance companies. From state-backed citizens property insurance. Now, those surplus lines, those are the generally often undercapitalized takeout companies like Five Dennis from Dunedin.
No, insurance surplus company. Lines. Surplus lines companies are usually like the very, very large. I mean, surplus lines companies can cover everything from the ship that ran into the bridge to Liberace's fingers. I mean, that's who writes those types of policies. They're usually very, very well capitalized. And they're often very large companies, and they write all kinds of specialty type products. So that's surplus lines is a little bit different. The admitted carriers are the ones that
the
really
Five Dennis from Dunedin.
Yeah, that's right.
It's like a $5 million amount or something to capitalize an insurance company.
15 is a minimum, but to get a rating, you have to have 25. Really, you need to 35. If you really want to be in the business, it's 50. So it's not, there's significant amounts of resources. The simple truth is, though, Citizens Property Insurance if Citizens Property Insurance was a regular insurance company, they would never be able to get a rating. Citizens has about $10 billion, maybe $11 billion in cash. They have access to more, but $10 billion or $11 billion in cash, and they have about $580 billion in total exposure because of they're writing about 1.2, 1.3 million policies right now. So, and a vast majority of the condos in Florida are being written by Citizens because that's largely a market that's being ignored by most admitted carriers. I think there's only two or three.
Being declined by most carriers.
Yeah, because most carriers aren't in that business. So it's a largely... It's a complicated world. It's one of the actually areas that Florida Policy Project is researching right now. But the reason I started Florida Policy Project was because my big takeaway after doing this job for 12 years, because I spent 2 years in the Florida House and a decade in the Florida Senate, was everything in Tallahassee is tactical. There is no strategy. So I couldn't tell you after 10 years what the strategy is for property insurance, what the strategy is for affordable housing, what the strategy is for transportation. And clearly our prison system has essentially no strategy. So my big takeaway was that it's all tactical. We do these year-to-year kind of moves, but we aren't playing to a larger goal.
And do you think that has to do with the fact that our legislators are term limited? They're in and they're out.
I actually think it has to do with both term limits and the fact that the Speaker and the Senate President really have about an 18-month shelf life, right? They have a 2-year term, but the last 6 months, they're out of office, right? Mm-hmm. We've already gone through session and they barely don't do anything. They're kind of lame ducks.
It's dead time.
So they have an 18-month term. And so imagine any organization that the senior leadership changed over every 18 months. I mean, it would be like schizophrenic. And unfortunately, Florida's one of the largest economies in the world, obviously third largest state. And we have this management team that consistently turns over. I mean, I've seen one Senate president completely wipe out another Senate president's priority the next year, mm-hmm. right? And those types of, that type of activity, I think what drives us to this tactical thinking.
Yeah. So what are you working on with regard to lowering property insurance through this Florida policy project?
Sure. So the bottom line in Florida property insurance is we need more market competition, and we need the state-run Citizens to kind of get out of the way. Citizens, while it has become almost more of a problem than the solution, really, to the broader fix. So understand this. In most markets, well, in Tampa Bay and Miami-Dade, the kind of two largest markets that Citizens insures, their rates are 50% below market. They're not actuarially sound. Citizens doesn't price on an actuarially sound basis. We require all other insurers to do that, but we don't require Citizens to do that. Citizens rates are set by politicians, not mathematicians. And because they're set by politicians, politicians don't want the rates to go up because obviously that would hurt a lot of people. And because you're 50% below market, in order to get to market, you have to raise rates 100%. And politicians are not going to do that. But in the meantime, more and more policies keep going to citizens, and that adds additional risk to their book that they don't want. Then they're trying to get away
from. So how do we get more competition for insurance?
So bottom line is, I mean, this is the ugly truth, is citizens have to begin to raise rates. We've done a lot of work on the litigation side, and we're seeing some really positive signs that litigation is actually dropping down. So it was not, a year and 2 years ago, Florida was 8% of all U.S. property claims in the country. We were 8% of claims. We were 80% of the litigation in the country. And so you can't be the most hurricane-prone state and the most litigious state and expect low property insurance rates.
Well, but now policyholders have no real remedy to go after bad faith.
Absolutely not true.
Payment of claims.
Well, I mean, they have the same remedy that they have in 48, 49 other states that never had the one-way attorney fee statute. Mm. So they can go to appraisal, they can go to mediation, they can call the Office of Insurance Regulation, they can call the CFO's office. There's a lot of pressure points you can put onto the property insurance companies.
But most of which are not here now. They've left the state, or they're insolvent. So how are we going to get back that competition these companies that don't want to take on the risk in Florida?
Well, because it wasn't a profitable business for the last 7 years to be in. So it's hard to tell people, come into Florida, start a new property insurance company, and lose money. So the business has to be profitable again. And in order to do that, we had to take care of the litigation side. But there's other things we can be doing. And part of the reason is we have to have this really heart-to-heart challenging conversation about citizens and understand that they're now a government-backed competitor to most of the private property insurance companies. That's basically agents are just throwing business at them because I don't blame the agents. I mean, it's cheaper for the clients.
What about this idea that in order for a company to sell auto insurance, which is also apparently the highest, the rates here are apparently the highest in the country. In order for a company to sell auto insurance, they have to now take on homeowners insurance.
Well, first of all, they would do a token amount, but they wouldn't write most of it. They would do if you force me to get into this business, you're going to force me. Can I only take 100 policies? Great. I'm just going to write 100 of my employees' policies. The simple truth is we shouldn't conflate those two. This is not a socialist economy. We should let the people that want to be in the business be in the business. And we should not force people that don't want to be in that business to be in the business.
Well, that's in some regard how we got here. They don't want to be in business in Florida. I mean, we are a risky state. Let's be honest.
Well,
then
we need to make it profitable to be in the business in Florida. At the end of the day, I would never take your money and force you to put it into a business that was unprofitable.
Right. But it also means the challenges for homeowners will be greater as they raise rates for citizens in order to, according to you, become competitive with private companies. Right now, we have some of the highest rates in the country, if not the highest.
We do. We do. And there's things that we need to be doing on the remediation side and other things that I think we can help bring rates down. But ultimately, what we need is a stable market. And when we have a stable market that's profitable, people will deploy capital into that. But as long as you have a market that's losing money every year, there's nobody who's going to deploy capital in that. And the simple truth is the insurers, actually some of them made money last year, and that's really positive, largely because that storm hit the Big Bend area and not the Tampa Bay market.
Mm-hmm. Well, all right. So at this point, we're talking mostly about raising rates.
I think rates for the private market are largely going to stabilize. They might go 5-10% this year. The condo market's a totally different world. Condo market, you could see rates going up 30-40% in the condo market because there's essentially very few carriers in the condo market right now that are and the condo market has, I would argue, been underpriced for many years, and they're kind of catching up to what the price actually should be. And inflation has hit the Florida market. Listen, that $300,000 home that you built 5 years ago is now worth if I wanted to rebuild it, it would cost $500,000. That is playing out in the condo world now too, where there's, the $80 million building is now worth $120 million or $150 million if I've got to rebuild it. Well, I've got to insure to that larger value.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well,
it's complicated. Let's say it that way.
Yeah. I'm not sure that I like what I'm hearing either, but all right. Let's move into the area of affordable housing.
Sure.
I want to talk about that in the context that this legislative session, Florida has now made it illegal for homeless people to sleep on public property unless they are inside a state-sanctioned homeless camp. And I know that affordable housing is one of your policy priorities. And so I want to ask you, do you think this is a good policy? And if we couple this with that House Bill 1451, that bill expands last year's Senate Bill 1718 by prohibiting local governments from recognizing identification cards issued by nonprofits that provide community IDs to undocumented immigrants. So are we just like filling our jails up with people who have unhoused and have no IDs and are potentially undocumented? And I know that your project has commissioned a report from FSU that it was going to look at best practices.
We have. That was one of the first reports we launched.
So tell us, what do you think about what happened out of the legislature on these issues and how it relates to the issue of affordable housing?
So I don't think this policy of not allowing people to sleep on public space is well thought out. First of all, they're going to move to private spaces. The churches and other places are absolutely going to open up, and they're going to have people sleeping in downtown areas, in public churches and parking lots and other places. Two, I think the law requires that the facilities that the cities and counties open be dry, like so there's no alcohol, no drugs. And I understand why the state does that. But then what happens to the people who are alcoholics and drug users? Where do they go, and what's the policy for them, right? Are we going to go push them in jail? And then they're part of the jail population. Then the jails fill up, and then what do we do? So I think, you know, I don't know that anybody said, well, what happens next after we pass this? I think we're ultimately going to see this as a very large unfunded mandate that puts real exposure on cities, because if cities don't do this,
if there's not
legitimate places in small counties and small cities for people to go to, then they have to provide not just the camps, it's not just a tent, you have to provide services as well, right? So if you're a small county that's barely making your budget work today, now you've got to put millions of dollars towards these homeless encampments because you have to have them. And if you don't, now you've created a cause of action. You're like, there's a liability that citizens can now sue the county over these types of issues. So I think we haven't really thought through this. This is a new experiment that we really haven't seen done in the country.
I don't think the camps are required. I think that if a local municipality decides to have a camp, it has to be in an area that won't affect surrounding property values.
But that's impossible.
Right, exactly.
Like, give me a break. Right. Where are you going to put in Pinellas County or Hillsborough that doesn't affect surrounding property values, right? Are you going to tell the people in downtown Hillsborough, hey, listen, you got to go to the Pasco County line in order to be part of that's our encampment?
Yeah, but that's why I think it's more of a problem for larger municipalities than it is for these small counties who barely make their budget. You know, they generally, I don't think, have that many relative to the rest of the population, homeless people.
They may not, but then they're still going to have to establish these places and services in localities. And this is why I think people are just going to stop sleeping on public spaces and sleeping on private spaces.
Or people are going to make a choice and decide that what they really need to do is expand their jails. You know, I mean, a lot of these small counties
That's not a long-term solution.
Of
I mean, listen. If you want to put somebody in jail in Pinellas or Hillsborough County, it's probably costing us $200 a day per person.
Yeah,
I mean, we can give them a housing voucher and get them at the local motel for $75 or $100 a night.
So, what should we be doing instead on this issue of affordable housing? On this issue of dealing with the unhoused population, what should we be doing instead?
So separating this out, so we're not talking anymore about the homeless encampment problem. We're talking about broader housing issues, right? And the simple truth, based on the research that we've done with Florida State and other organizations that we've seen, is the best practice is really, if you don't fix zoning, you don't fix housing. And so we have largely single family home zoning in most of the communities around Florida. And we need to talk about upzoning. We need to talk about having more flexibility to add duplexes and triplexes. We really need.
So you're a YIMBY guy.
I am a YIMBY.
Yes, absolutely. My backyard guy.
We need accessory dwelling units. We need, because I can tell you, if you want to build a new apartment in Pinellas County right now, it's going to cost you $300,000 a unit. And there's no real way to make that affordable without huge government subsidies. And so ultimately, we have to think about what we need more units to come online. Well, what are the lower cost units? Accessory dwelling units, garage apartments, mother-in-law suites, whatever you want to call them, we can build those for $150,000 to $170,000 a unit. And so those are important pieces. There's no panacea, there's no silver bullet, there's no one-size-fits-all kind of solution to this. The simple truth is, if you don't fix zoning, you don't fix housing, you need accessory dwelling units, you need to have conversations with developers about smaller lot sizes. Largely, we have these, you know, quarter acre lots is kind of the standard. Well, we need to have smaller lot sizes and make new communities the flexibility to offer smaller lot sizes as well, because we have to increase our density. But in built out communities like Tampa and Pinellas County, the simple solution is you've got to rethink density, which largely requires you to rethink zoning. Apartments are important. You need to be focusing on that. But the simple truth is you're never going to get there with public housing. How do we incentivize developers to put affordable units in every new project that they do? And that's going to require a conversation with developers about what incentives they need in order to add. You know, if you're building 500 units, what does it take to put 30 or 40 make those 30 affordable, permanently affordable? What is the incentive that we need to offer you?
What do you think about this live local law?
Well, I think live local was a 3% solution, maybe mostly designed for apartment developers.
Right. And developers who were building apartments anyway.
Yeah, they were building apartments anyway. And I think it's a 3% solution. And I think you're starting to see cities and counties begin to reject it because they don't feel like they were part of that conversation. I think the best thing that community, if it was going to ask me how to redesign the housing system for Florida, we would make it block grants to counties. But we would require the counties to come up with a plan based on best practices. And it would be like a Chinese menu. Like, you have to select something from option A, something from option B, something from option C. And if you don't select from those, like, you can say, no, we don't want to do any of that. Great. You just don't get access to the affordable housing dollars that the state's going to put down. So you really need counties and cities to buy into these ideas. But they need to be organic to those communities. But there's things that simple truth is, if you don't fix zoning, you don't fix housing. And these cities are struggling to have these conversations because there's the YIMBY movement, there's the NIMBY movement. There's right. The not in my backyard. I don't want accessory dwelling units in my backyard. I don't want duplexes in my community. Right. And then I tell people, go drive around Old Northeast. And what do you see in Old Northeast in St. Petersburg? You're going to see a single family home, and then you're going to see a duplex, and then you're going to see a small garden style apartment, and then you're going to see other. So it's this whole mixture that was built in the 1920s. And people say, well, I don't want that. That'll change. If I add these types of things to my community, it will change the nature of my community. Drive down that community and tell me it isn't the nature of that community. Mm-hmm. It's all about what that community is about, because you have different people of different income levels living in very close proximity, and it all works just fine. Mm-hmm. So I struggle to see that connection where people say, well, it's going to change the nature of my community. I don't think it is.
Well, outside of the city limits, though, where people are very protective of their, exurban or semi-rural, and in many cases, suburban planned communities, I think that's where the issue is, that, people don't want their little gated planned community to be next to a major apartment complex, for example.
That might be true, but for the most part, we need to be focusing on our major cities and counties, because that's where we're struggling to get housing that's affordable. I mean, listen, if you go to any of these hospitals and you talk to their, $25 an hour employees, and you realize, that they're struggling to find a place to live near the hospital.
Yeah, and all of this is tied to transportation, isn't it?
It is. Well, and that's the challenge. Like, if you say, well, we're not going to do any density increase in our major cities and we're going to make it all suburbia, well, then we've got to get people from suburbia to the major cities, which hurts the transportation issues. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where I think Florida needs a robust voucher program. And I think that's where one of the areas that you'll see our next report coming out on in the Florida Policy Project is we really need a robust housing voucher program, because we want people to live in market rate units. And if we establish essentially government housing, then we create pockets of poverty. And if we establish, if we have them living in market rate units and we provide housing vouchers for them to do it, one, we get them housed much quicker because these units to build take 3 to 5 years. Mm-hmm. The existing units, we can put them in a few days. Mm-hmm. So we need a robust housing voucher program in Florida. And so I think those are the things that we're really focused on as the Florida Policy Project. In fact, we have a summit coming up on May 1st called the Florida Housing Summit.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, so we're bringing in national experts to talk about what Florida should be doing on the affordable housing side. The simple truth is Florida's where California was 10, 15, 20 years ago. And if we don't get our act together, we're going to find it's going to get harder and harder. And what we're seeing now is cities kind of using fuzzy math in order to get to their housing numbers. But the simple truth is there's not enough resources at the city level, the county level. And frankly, the state has not set up the correct incentives to incentivize the cities and counties to do the right thing, because the state doesn't know what it wants to do. And they aren't doing, and this is my big complaint about the legislative session, is on the major issues, they missed the mark. I think they did the handful of things they wanted to do. I would say this legislative session was neither great nor terrible. I think I rated it a 4.6 out of 10. It was a kind of an average session, but on the big issues, they totally missed the ball on property insurance, on transportation, on affordable housing, on the prison system. There was essentially very little action going on.
Those are the issues that your policy project is focused on. So I know you have a lot to talk about there. But since we went from affordable housing, I think that the natural progression of this discussion has to go to transportation now. Because, it is one of your policy priorities. And I want to look at it in the context of how we recently learned that DeSantis and the Florida legislature will not release the entirety of the funds collected from the now void Hillsborough County transportation tax back to Hillsborough County for Hillsborough County priority transportation projects. Instead, only about $256 million of the $589 million collected from that tax will go toward road improvements in Hillsborough County. But that's not what the people here voted for. Less than half of the money will go toward actual transportation projects, and the rest is going to be spent on legal fees from when the tax was sent to the Florida Supreme Court. There's a small refund program for people who apply to have the money spent on the tax sent back to them, and for supplementing the cost of additional tax holidays in the county. Is this good transportation policy making? I mean, most of the transportation funding local communities that they will get is not from the generosity of the Florida legislature, but now it's Biden bucks. It's from the federal infrastructure bill and other federal measures. So, I mean, let's talk about that Hillsborough tax issue first. Is that good policy?
I think this is a settlement that literally nobody's happy with.
Yeah.
And I think this is a bad deal for everybody. It's done. It's going to happen.
That's not what the people voted for. That's not what they wanted.
Well, but obviously, look, they could have kept that money up there for years and years, and they could have not been deployed here. But everybody said, look, we just want to get a deal done. We want money back in the community, and we just need it, you know, and the state wanted this issue over with. And so they cut this deal. Nobody's really happy with it. I understand that, but there is resources coming back to Hillsborough. They will be used on transportation, not on all the things you want to use on road repair, right? But there's, trust me, driving around Hillsborough, there's plenty of potholes and road repair that needs to happen, right? So I don't think it's overwhelmingly negative. I don't think it's overwhelmingly positive. I think it's a middle of the road deal that nobody's really happy with because nobody got everything they want, but that's probably the best you're going to get out of Tallahassee right now.
Okay. And, like I said, we have Biden bucks coming into the community in terms of the infrastructure bill. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
Well, look, the Floor Policy Project is focusing on best practices. We think one of the best practices, one of the things we're working on right now is signal light timing. So the best return on investment in all of transportation, I would argue, and we're actually working with USF on a project right now on this discussion, is having signals timed appropriately so that you're not sitting in traffic waiting at a stoplight when it's not timed right. And what we found is like about 70% in Hillsborough County of their signals are on simple timers and are not, not adjustable from an external source. And that's a problem because we need to, with the world of AI and the world of transportation kind of computer management, we should be able to time these lights much better than we currently do. And so one of the projects we're working on right now is to kind of really highlight that and show what a problem that is and try to get the state to reset its standards for how signals should be timed.
Oh, that's all right. That's interesting. Listen, if you've just joined us, we are talking to former state of Florida Senator Jeff Brandis, who is now the founder of the Florida Policy Project, looking at best practices for policy and governance in Florida, hopefully to make our lives a little better here. If you have some thoughts about the recent legislative session or some questions for Senator Brandis, you can call us at 813-239-9663, or you can email dj@wmnf.org or text us at 813-433-0885. All right. One of your other policy project priorities is criminal justice and prison reform. And this year, the legislature increased the criminal penalties and prison sentences for shoplifting, and they restricted local citizen review boards on police misconduct. Those good policies?
I don't think the Citizens Review Board is a good policy. I think they're kind of kowtowing to the unions on that one. I don't think the unions, the police officers really want Citizens Review Boards looking at them. I don't think that's good policy. I think what makes us the communities that we are is we have citizen review. Right. And I think Tampa and Pinellas both have citizen review boards, and Tampa's obviously had some controversy over it over the years. But Pinellas's and the city of St. Petersburg's has, I would say, worked pretty well. And I think you want that external review. I think they want that external accountability. I think that's all positive. I don't think less citizen accountability is generally better in some cases. I think they can get squirrely, but that this is where you ultimately have a city council that helps make these decisions, but city council can't be everywhere and do everything. And so I think that was a mistake to get away from those.
The shoplifting thing, it's often a juvenile crime, and I know you've been looking at juvenile justice issues and reentry programs.
But there are organized rings of shoplifting too, right? And so, one of the things I worked on when I was in the legislature was adjusting the felony threshold for theft, right? It used to be Florida had one of the lowest felony thresholds in the country. It was $350. If you stole $350, you could be considered a felon for the rest of your life, which seemed a little intense, and so we were able to move that. I think the 750 is where we did that. And it's still kind of mid-range in the country. And, people said, oh, you can't do that. That's terrible. We're going to have all this. The simple truth is there's best practices for dealing with all of these types of issues. And Florida should spend money and research. What are the best practices for reducing shoplifting? What are the right penalties for this, for this crime? And that's where I'm kind of pushing the legislature to be a little bit more scientific and thoughtful than sticking their finger up in the air and saying,
I'm tough on crime.
Right. We want to do this. I think what the Florida Policy Project and one of the things that I worked on before I left the legislature in 2022 was getting our prison study a thorough review of the prison system. And so we were able to work with the Department of Management Services, bring in a group called KPMG, which is a global consulting firm, and do a deep dive into the prison system. And what they said is the prison system is a hot mess. Basically, the Florida prison system is essentially a slum, and we don't offer correcting services inside the Department of Corrections. We really just warehouse people. Mm-hmm. They said you need to spend $2.2 billion immediately to fix plumbing issues, electrical issues, roofing issues. You have blue tarps all over the floor of prison system's roof. You have leaks going, active leaks going on in the prison system today.
Air conditioning.
75% of the facilities are not air conditioned.
Yeah.
You aren't hiring enough corrections officers. We don't have corrections officers. We have some corrections facilities with 72% vacancy of corrections officers. Mm. A number of them with 60% vacancies. We have 400 members of the National Guard currently operating as corrections prison guards, if you will. They're not corrections officers, but they're prison guards. Because if we didn't have them, we would have to issue emergency releases. And they don't want to do that, obviously. Mm-hmm. So now you have essentially two companies of soldiers that are now actively and probably permanently at the prison system, which is not what these people signed up to do. And that just is a show, it highlights a failure of the legislature to really address these issues in a meaningful way. The simple truth is the Florida prison system was set up so that if you get sentenced to prison in Pinellas County, and you knew this as a former defense attorney, mm-hmm. you're going to go to jail in the panhandle because that's where all the prisons are. Mm-hmm. They're in the rural communities in the panhandle. Unfortunately, there isn't a labor pool anymore to support rural communities in the rural prisons in the panhandle, and there aren't services that are able to be provided. So we can't provide psychological services. We can't provide addiction services because there aren't specialists that live up there. Mm. And so Florida really has to rethink its entire prison system. And so I just wrote an op-ed for the Miami Herald that says, listen, we need a commission. We need a commission that's going to do a deep dive for multiple years, that's going to study the Florida prison system and really say, all right, these are the prisons that need to be closed. These are the prisons that need to be opened and new prisons that need to be established. And here's where we need to locate them. The simple truth is the legislature is not designed to do this. You're not going to do this in three committee hearings over, once in a 1 year period in a session. That's never going to happen. You need a standing commission that brings the legislature a report and says, listen, just implement this. Mm-hmm. And here's why we did this. And you need it staffed with experts. I would put some former legislators on there. I would put some experts on there, but really think through, dive through that report and think about modernizing the prison system of Florida.
Yeah, I think that's a critical need. I mean, I started my legal career in the years immediately after the Attica prison riots. Mm-hmm. And, we can see that if these things are not addressed, it's a dangerous situation. It's really, it's critical right now.
Yeah, I think Florida has a Department of Warehousing. It doesn't have a Department of Corrections. Yeah. And we do not actively correct behavior. We just warehouse people until they get old.
Yeah. Exactly. And there was a recent article about how so many of the prisoners now are in prison in Florida past the time when the judges who sentenced them have died, mm-hmm. passed on.
I think it's a bad situation. That's a ripe area for best practice research. And frankly, we should be spending a lot more money and research doing it. And I think that's one of my biggest complaints, that the legislature has kind of dropped the ball on doing real research. And it's partly, and I also fault the public universities for this. Right, we have what we call tier one public universities. I can tell you, in my time as a legislator, I never had a university ever come to me with research that they've done to solve a problem that the state of Florida has on property insurance, on criminal justice, on transportation, on housing. Zero times. And I can tell you that's probably the experience of every one of my other colleagues, is that they've had zero. And it's partly because the legislature disincentivizes universities from providing real research. So understand this, the legislature finished session in March. It will not go back into session until March of next year. So they have a full year. They should be filling this year up with research on property insurance, on transportation, shoplifting if you want it, on affordable housing, and on the prison system. To me, this is the time that we come back in to legislative session armed with all of this research that we've done, and let's hire the universities to do it. They have professors and PhDs that are very knowledgeable on these issues, and that's what we should be spending this next year on.
All right. Well, going back to juvenile justice for a minute, though, And I hope that the universities take you up on your challenge. I really do. But I want to just direct your attention to the bill that loosened child labor laws and allowed businesses to employ teenagers for longer hours. Is this a positive step in regard to keeping juveniles out of the system? Well, or is it exploitative in a way to fill jobs that DeSantis doesn't want to fill with immigrants?
I don't think it's exploitative. I think ultimately we have this kind of Dr. Seuss push me, pull me going on in the legislature. On one hand, we're saying, parents, you cannot make any decisions as it relates to social media and your kids, and you are not responsible for you. We are removing that responsibility and parental authority from you to determine what your kids can utilize their phones or their internet access for. On the other hand, we're saying, but you have incredible discretion on where they can work all day long. Listen, wherever you come down on this, it really just helps to have a consistent North Star of where you want parental responsibility to be. And I think this is the kind of schizophrenic things that we're seeing out of the legislature, where we're saying, we want you to have school choice. We want you to have an incredible amount of flexibility on school choice. We want you to be able to, if your kid wants to work, he can work wherever they want to work for longer hours. Now, that's fine. But on the other hand, we can't allow you to determine what's best for your kid as it relates to the internet. That's just too much for you parents. I'm sorry, we're going to take that responsibility away from you as a state. I don't think listen, I'm much more of a libertarian. I would describe myself as a capital L libertarian, little r a Republican. And I would say that just violates my libertarian soul. Listen, I don't mind that you have shifting policy positions, but like, be consistent about some things.
Well,
like,
I have to ask, you know, since you brought it up, I have to ask, are you still a Republican?
I am. Look, I want to fix the party from
what,
inside.
What flavor of Republican are you? MAGA Republican? Loyalist?
I'm a libertarian Republican.
Okay.
I think there are things that I think there's things I absolutely agree with my colleagues on, and there's absolutely things I disagree with my colleagues on. And I think that's, but you need people that fight for what they believe in from the inside. I'm not somebody who says, oh, let's just everybody abandon the party if you disagree with something. No, you need people, because what I found my lane in the legislature was, I wanted to hold my Republican colleagues that were accountable. So when they started doing things that I thought was crazy, I said, you know, look, where is this Republican? Understand, you know, let me just give you two examples on the kind of sin issues of Florida, right? On marijuana and on gambling. On marijuana, we entered this green field, and Republicans, being this free market group, basically created a drug cartel with a handful of operators who can operate that business. And if you and I wanted to be in the business of growing, processing, distributing marijuana legally, we would have to come up with $40 or $50 million. And so it basically kept all the small businesses out and get us a handful of people really, really rich. We created our own drug cartel, and the governor has said as much. Mm-hmm. On gambling, when it came to allowing companies to get into sports betting, we gave it all to the Seminole tribe. We create a cartel. We created a monopoly as Republicans. This is the kind of thing that is like violates that isn't Republican. Nobody will tell you that that's free market. That is completely anti-free market. Mm-hmm. This is the opposite of free market. And so this is where I found my voice in saying, you guys aren't even upholding your own principles. And so it's a lot easier to do that from inside the chamber, from inside the Republican Party, than is for me to kind of shift parties, or I would never do that, but shift parties and go outside and poke holes at them. So I think...
Well, but if you're still a Republican, will you support Trump in November?
Look, I'm...
it's a question that needs to be answered. Hey,
listen, I'm a big Jeb fan.
Not running. And we have a binary election.
Look, I think there are good points of Donald Trump, and I think there are some terrible points of Donald Trump.
Yeah, but you got to pick a side.
And we'll see how it all plays out in a few months.
Uh-huh. So you're not going to answer me, huh?
I love a secret ballot.
Okay. You've seen what happened to Laura Lee,
congresswoman. I saw what happened to her.
From Polk area.
Well, Laura Lee's an incredibly talented individual. She knew what she was getting herself into when she made the decisions she made.
Yeah, let's tell our listeners so they know what we're talking about. Laura Lee, congresswoman from Hillsborough and I think part of Polk County. She was the only member of the Florida congressional delegation to endorse DeSantis DeSantis over Trump.
Right.
And even though she endorsed Trump as soon as DeSantis dropped out, now Trump is demanding that a MAGA Republican come out and challenge her in this election. And it looks like Jackie Toledo wants to accept that challenge and possibly other people as well. So what do you think about that?
Well, I mean,
is there a place for you back in electoral politics?
I think there is. I mean, I think there is. I think there's, you know, but I think I'm doing great work on the Florida Policy Project. I think I'm being incredibly effective working with legislative leaders to help solve some of these tough problems. I think Laura Lee is incredibly talented. I think she would make a great state attorney. I mean, attorney general. I think she'd make a great state attorney. I think she's got tons of opportunity for her.
She was a federal prosecutor, but she
obviously come back and be a state attorney if she wanted, or she could be the attorney general. I think, you know, Ashley Moody has done it a couple of years, and I think that she would be great at that position as well. So I think Laurel's got an incredible future. This is a rough period. But listen, she is a very smart and talented individual. She knew exactly what she was doing when she made her decision. And, you know, look, like I did when I made some of my decisions in the legislature, you kind of know how this is going to play out. But you do it anyway because you believe it's the right thing to do. And I think Laurel went with her heart, and it was, you know, for her, it was the right thing to do.
Well, what are your future political plans? Are you going to make a run for governor in 26?
I think I want to keep my options open, and I think I want to understand the deeper policy issues and be as effective as I can as both, you know, like I have four kids, so I love spending time with them. I have a business that I've running, and a variety of different opportunities that I'm involved in. And I have the Florida Policy Project, which my number one goal is to make it the think tank of Florida that is not considered a partisan hack group, but is really thinking about the big problems, that's partnering with our public universities, and that's working on helping solve some of these big challenges. I think I come from it with a unique perspective. Most people don't have 12 years in the legislature. Most people don't have the relationships that I have, both on the Republican side and Democrat side, to work on a bipartisan way to solve some of these problems. And I will tell you, I don't think transportation, I don't think criminal justice, I don't think property insurance, and I don't think housing are partisan issues. I think these are issues that need solutions. And I don't think people care whether it's left or right. We want to get it right. And this is why my goal has been get the legislature to begin to develop a series of best practices and then just move every year towards best practices. If we're going to live in this world where we're tactical over strategic, then can we at least make the tactical moves to move towards a best practice every year? And understand those best practices are evolving, but I want to engage our public universities to help them solve some of these problems. I think the legislature, while it spends hundreds of millions of dollars in the universities, isn't spending it on the right things in the universities because it isn't really providing day-to-day benefits to Floridians on a lot of these issues. And we should be working with them to address some of these problems.
And how are we going to do that when we still have term limits and when we have so much money in politics, when people are so people in the legislature are so responsive to lobbyists who come
there?
There
will always be that. There will always be the political pressure on the right and the left. Look, it goes both ways, right? There's absolutely the right and the left, the challenge. But I think if we can agree that we want to adapt and move towards best practices, it's hard to argue with that. If somebody says, look, here's the best practices in housing and prisons and stuff like that, yeah, there's going to be always people who disagree with that. But if we can generally accept those best practices and we can move every year towards that, I think that's positive. I think ultimately you need a goal to hit, right? Like I always told people when they came with me with new ideas, I said, listen, if you want to be successful in the legislature, you need two things. You need a vision, and you need a champion. And I will tell you, in most areas of public policy, we have neither a vision for what we want to be or where we want to go, or a champion. Let's at least let our vision be that we want to move towards best practices, and we want Florida to be a best practice focused state. And then we will help develop champions to get us there.
Well, at this point, you know, we've had a Republican supermajority in the legislature for quite some time now, and I wonder how you think that affects our ability to get toward a best practices focused legislature.
Well, I mean, I think we have to.
I mean, we don't have that bipartisan.
We don't have it on either side. We don't have it either side because that's not how Tallahassee thinks. what we need to be doing is establishing this as the standard is we're going to move towards best practices. And then we're going to work on developing out what those best practices are using the best experts we can find to help us develop out those best practices. What I often find is people show up to legislative session or get into committee weeks in September or October, and by that time it's too late. You're not going to get research done in 2 months. Mm. The best you could do is probably ask ChatGPT, what are the best practices in these things? I'm not saying that legislators haven't done that or aren't going to do that. They probably are, because that's all they have time to do if they don't plan this stuff 2 years out. I'm a pilot. One of the favorite pieces of advice I got as a pilot was you always try to stay ahead of the airplane, right? You're putting in your frequencies early. You're putting in all your information early before you get there, maybe sometimes hours before you get to that point. So you don't have to do it then and you're not in a rush. Oftentimes what I'm finding is the legislature gets behind. And the legislature gets behind, and then it starts rushing. And that's when mistakes happen. And that's where they make they aren't fulfilling what I think is the goal of the legislature and moving policy forward and taking on these big issues.
Well, we've seen such a focus in the last not this session as much, but in the previous session on all this anti-woke legislation, for example.
Well, I think this was an interesting session because DeSantis got in kind of in the second half of session, right? He got off the campaign trail. Right. And he's back in. And I think that definitely the legislature was not used to that. First of all, for the last 3 or 4 years, he had been very engaged in the front end of session. And now he was only engaged on the back end of session. And I think so I think he didn't come in with a kind of a laundry list of priorities that he wanted to accomplish this year. I think the legislature was able to have more freedom to move around the cabin, if you will. And I think that's a growing experience for them and something they hadn't experienced in a few years.
Yeah, and they didn't. There wasn't as much anti-woke legislation. There wasn't as much red meat as in the past session.
Well, I think that was largely attributed to Kathleen Pasadomo, the Senate president, who I think was much more focused on just getting through and solving some of these bigger public policy issues that she cared about and not taking on some of the other things.
And not taking on some important public policy issues, like in her first speech she announced, we're not going to expand Medicaid this session. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
Well, I don't think the legislature is going to expand Medicaid anytime soon. And I think ultimately these states that did expand Medicaid are going to find out that the federal government's not going to be able to back with their money. I mean, with the amount of federal debt that you have right now, they're going to have to rethink some of these federal programs.
Oh, well, I wish we had more time to talk about that. And I wonder if there's any issues that you're going to expand your policy project into as you move forward.
So look, there's 4 areas of public policy. We're going to stay very focused on those. We may do some special reports here and there. But, we're working right now actively, and you'll see reports coming out in the next few weeks on a primer on property insurance. You'll see a report coming out on housing vouchers and how Florida should work on housing vouchers. I told you a little bit about the transportation study on signal light timing. But, I look for actionable solutions that the legislature can implement and will make a real difference over the long term for Florida.
What do you think about the legislature taking all power unto itself with its focus on preempting home rule ordinances and local control over
things. I can tell you there is good preemption and there's bad preemptions. And it's somewhere between, I think Governor DeSantis' standard has somewhere between, plastic straws, which he says is not preemptible. And heat ordinances, which they believe they are. And yeah. So I think we've got to figure out what the real standard is. I think there are times you absolutely have to preempt. I ran the bill for Uber and Lyft in Florida. And I can tell you, that bill would never have happened had we not preempted to the state. And if Hillsborough County and the city of Tampa could have kept taxi cabs from St. Petersburg from being able to cross over and drop people off or Ubers and Lyfts over to drop people off. That would have never happened.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate you being here. That's it for us. We are kind of out of time right now. It's been a great conversation with my guest, Senator Jeff Brandis of Pinellas County, former Florida senator and founder of the Florida Policy Project. I really thank you for joining us on WMNF's Midpoint Wednesday. Thanks also to our intrepid WMNF volunteer production staff, Jessica Green and Barbara Fling. We are your independent, non-commercial community media, and we are happy you joined us. Next week, Gary Gibbons will be substituting for me on Midpoint, and he'll be bringing you a great show, possibly on the Tropicana Field Resurrection and Reformation. And now Talking Animals is up next with Duncan Strauss. We are WMNF Tampa.